A Maine author's exploration of GMOs and whether or not they are harmful to our health and our environment. Author Caitlin Shetterly's journey into the world of genetically modified food and agriculture started because of her own serious health issues. After a Maine doctor advised her to avoid genetically modified corn, Shetterly's health improved dramatically. 5 years later, after traveling throughout the U.S. and Europe and talking to scientists, farmers, and policymakers on all sides of the GMO issue, Shetterly has published a book that recounts her odyssey and what she learned. It's titled Modified: GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with Caitlin Shetterly about genetically modified food and farming and why it's so difficult to determine GMO's impact on human health and the environment. Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Genetically modified food is a hot-button issue. To some, GMOs offer the potential to help feed the ever-expanding global population. Others worry about potential dangers to human health and the fields where GMO crops are planted. Today, we're going to hear one journalist's story of trying to understand just what GMOs may mean to our food chain and to our health. Author Caitlin Shetterly's new book is Modified: GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you give much thought to the role of GMOs in our food supply? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Caitlin, congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me.
It's so interesting. The book begins with your personal story of sickness and health and a meeting with a doctor in Yarmouth. I'd like you to start here, if you could, by telling me how you got involved in this issue and your own personal story a little bit.
Yeah, so I had no idea that I was going to get involved in this issue. Shortly after I got married, I became sick with an illness that no one could diagnose. And it seemed to be autoimmune in nature, and I spent a lot of time going back and forth to Boston and seeing everyone in the Portland metropolitan area who would possibly see me. And I had, you know, sort of a bucket. It was sort of a bucket illness. I had all these different symptoms, pain throughout my body and rashes and exhaustion. And especially my hands were very arthritic and hurt. And, you know, my husband used to make these splints for me at night out of cardboard and tape to sort of hold my hands flat while I slept, because they would seem to curl and get very painful while I was sleeping. And no one could figure out what was wrong with me. And I had brain scans and neurological workups and saw everyone, as I say in the book, from Harvard educated MDs to shamans. And eventually I met an immunologist in Yarmouth who suggested that he had been seeing an uptick in these sort of autoimmune-seeming allergic responses, these sort of immunogenicity, essentially. And he believed it was tied to the advent of the GMO, and in particular to GMO corn, because it's like soy, it has proliferated into our foodscape. And so he suggested I take corn and soy out of my diet.
And it had to be all corn and soy because there aren't labels now and because corn is everywhere.
Corn is everywhere. Unlike, you know, soy is a little bit of a different issue, but corn, wind pollinates, and pollinators like birds and bees and butterflies carry the pollen, and it's very hard to contain corn. One of the complications of it is that, you know, even GMO corn that's in field trials, it's not in a hermetically sealed environment. It's being grown out in the open air. So, you know, there are GMO corn varieties that are stacked with many traits, and then there are new things that they're trying out. And those are often being grown right next to each other, the deregulated and the regulated corn.
I was struck that some of the things you had to avoid, obviously, a tortilla chip is obviously made out of corn, but you were avoiding things like paper cups.
Yeah, so the wax lining on the inside of a paper cup is often made from a vegetable wax, which contains GMO corn. And corn shows up in all these random places like baking powder and iodized salt. Morton salt has dextrose in it, which is made from GMO corn. our sneakers, plastic. We make plastics at this point. You could buy a Coke, which has corn syrup in it, and the bottle could be made from GMO corn. So corn shows up in a lot of surprising places that you might not expect, for sure.
So after you tried your very hardest to get all traces of corn from your diet, were you better?
That was the thing that was sort of remarkable, is that I was skeptical about the whole thing. In fact, I remember when he said this to me, thinking, GM, what? I had no idea really what he was talking about. It was 2011. Of course, GMOs were sort of out there, but I hadn't really spent much time thinking about them. But I did it because I was too desperate not to. So I did what he suggested, and we changed our diet to all local and organic and homemade. And a couple of months later, I was better. I was myself again. And the question for me became sort of why. It was, I think I'm naturally a person who asks questions. I'm skeptical even with my own judgment of things. I want to know more. And so I entered into this field, but I can't say that I did it with, guns blazing. I was going to go out and sort of take on Big Ag. I was actually in the middle of a novel. I was about 75 pages in. But I opened this dark little closet and I peered in and I thought, oh, gee, there's some interesting things in there. And I quickly shut the door. But then I kind of peeked in again, and it led to a long journey of questions and interviewing people and trying to understand exactly what the GMO is and then what goes along with it, and what we need to be thinking about and why we aren't talking about some of the things that I think we should be talking about when we talk about GMOs.
So I understand that the book is called Modified: GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. I understand you're not crazy about the title of your own book.
No, well, I love Modified. I think that's a terrific title. Not crazy about it. The subtitle, I think, in some ways is probably the harshest thing in the book. I took great pains to look at all sides of the issue and to interview people on all sides. I interviewed Monsanto seed scientists and scientists who do lobbying for Monsanto as well. And I interviewed politicians and anyone who would really talk to me, people at the USDA. And so I think the subtitle sort of implies that perhaps I'm going to not give a balanced reportage. But in the end, I really did talk to anyone who would talk to me. I do believe that coming full circle, when I, in summa, sort of look at the GMO issue, I do believe they are a threat to our environment. I became, while working on this book, frankly, kind of heartbroken. And I remember there was a moment towards the end of my reporting when I was on an airplane flying back from California, where I'd been interviewing two scientists who had dared to stand up to Big Ag. And I just felt this sadness wash over me, just that I had no idea how big the problem is and how serious the issue is with the pesticides and the chemicals that we're pumping into the environment, and how it's affecting innocent creatures as well as my own children. And so I do believe the GMO and how we're doing growing our agriculture is a huge threat to our planet, actually. Our agriculture is the biggest contributor to climate change. And these pesticides are a very serious issue we need to look at. But I took incredible pains to talk to everyone who would talk to me and to present every side of the issue.
Well, and if your book makes anything clear, it is that this is a really complicated issue.
Yeah, certainly. Yes. It's very complicated. I had to learn a lot of science and learn a lot about agriculture and learn about medicine as best I could. Being a writer, not a scientist or a doctor or a farmer, I had to learn these sort of on the ground. And often I was the only woman in a totally man's field. I was, my friend Susan read an early draft of the book and she turned to me and said, there are a lot of men mansplaining in this book. Can you get a couple women in there? So I sort of rushed around and tried to find some women. It was very complicated. I take real pains to write the book in an extremely conversational manner There are little drawings by me and woodcuts by my husband and a drawing by my 7-year-old son in the book. And I try to explain everything in a way that people can understand, either with little drawings or with my language.
I was struck by a lot of things in your book, but one of them, Caitlin, was how quickly GMO agriculture has become so huge. I think we all understand that it's becoming more commonplace, especially corn and soybeans, but the scale and how quickly is really astonishing.
It's astonishing. And it's, that's, you know, I had no idea. So when I began this book, one of the first things I said to myself was, okay, so what I need to do is go on and get on an airplane. And I flew out to Denver, Colorado, and I drove across eastern Colorado and across the Great Plains. And I felt I needed to see GMO corn and soy, you know, sort of in the flesh. I needed to see what they looked like. But I had no idea. I was not prepared for what Michael Pollan calls the corn cities of Iowa, or the sort of fence post to fence post sort of ubiquity of these crops, and how sloughs and wetlands and, you know, virgin prairie and all these things have been filled in, you know, raised or filled in order to grow these crops. I didn't realize there wouldn't be hardly any land left. And as we have continued to grow GMOs across the planet, you know, we are sort of taking turns into this brave new world, and we're growing GMO trees and all kinds of different kinds of crops, and we're cutting down forests and prairie in order to do so. And it was startling to me and scary.
You liked many of the people you met on both sides of this issue, on all sides. I understand there are more than two sides of this issue, didn't you? You understand why the folks who support GMO, the scientists who work on GMOs, do what they do.
Yeah, I mean, that's probably one of the things that's probably, you know, good and bad about me, is that in my heart, I'm an optimist and I want to get along with everybody. And so I did like some of these people, and especially, you know, one of the things I think also being a journalist is that I'm a chameleon. When somebody was explaining something to me and they were fervently in favor of the GMO and they could tell me all their reasons, they would convince me. And then it wasn't until later sometimes that I write about in the book, lying in bed, putting my little son to bed, and my mind would be sort of skipping like a scratch CD on this one thing. And then I would go back to them with more questions. So there were always, you know, there was always more to ask, for sure. But yes, I a lot of these people I liked a lot. One of my favorite people was a young farmer named Zach Honeycutt, who I spent the day with in Nebraska while he was harvesting his GMO soy. He also grows GMO corn and popcorn. You know, he became very helpful to me. And another scientist, Richard Goodman, who I don't think would probably consider us to be friends necessarily, but he was extremely helpful to me. He endlessly spent time on the phone with me, despite the fact that I think he knew that I was leaning towards thinking the GMO wasn't a great thing, but he still gave me a lot of time and information.
Let me step back a little bit and say, as you just said, leaning toward thinking GMO wasn't a great thing. I think a whole lot of people care about the food they eat. Obviously, we're having this conversation in Maine, where the local food movement is a really big part of our culture and our economy. But GMOs are a hard thing to understand. What is the difference between what we've done for generations with crops like apples and pears, grafting, and what GMO is? And why is... I mean, I think some people think, well, just because it's new doesn't mean it's dangerous.
Yeah, that I understand that point of view. I guess I would, to answer the first question, sort of, what is a GMO? I spend a lot of time in the beginning of the book explaining that and drawing little pictures. And, you know, farmers for 10,000 years have worked with their crops to make them perform the best in their little patch of earth. Grafting, for instance, with apples, you know, if you have a Macintosh apple, but you want to grow Granny Smiths, you could cut off a branch of a Granny Smith apple and cut off the a branch of the Macintosh, and you could tie on that Granny Smith apple branch with some twine, and everything above the graft will make those Granny Smith apples. With GMOs, it's a little different. They're made in a lab. You're introducing something that's you know, a different species, in fact, usually from a different phyla entirely, into the GMO. So, for instance, GMO corn carries something called a cry protein, or many cry proteins for various pests. And these come from a bacteria. There's no way to make corn and bacteria mate. And these bacteria are insecticidal in nature. And then there are other traits that are stacked into corn to make it resistant to Roundup or glyphosate, the herbicide that Monsanto makes. And many other traits are now engineered into corn. The easiest example I like to tell people when they need to think about the GMO and what it exactly is there was a frost-proof strawberry that was made a while back. And what they did is they took DNA from a flounder, which sits at the bottom of the ocean and does not freeze, and they took that DNA and they put it inside the cells of the strawberry to make the strawberry frost-proof. So I joke that, you know, a strawberry and a flounder would never mate in nature, no matter how juicy that strawberry looked or how randy that flounder was. And so I think we need to understand that usually these are two different species. It can only be done in a lab, generally with a gene gun, sometimes with something called agrobacterium, which is a bacterium which carries the DNA. And then there's this newer frontier called CRISPR, which is not going to require, it sounds like, any regulation at all, which, you know, the GMOs themselves don't have a ton of regulation. So these things need to be made in labs. And the question is, are we thinking through all of the possibilities when we do this? Do we understand exactly how this is going to perform in the environment? And many of the scientists I spoke to said, no, we don't understand. We need to sort of say halt until we start asking the right questions, because once it's out there, it's out there. There's no going back. And we've certainly found that with corn. It's almost impossible to find a pure corn source anywhere on the planet that isn't contaminated with GMO corn. So we need to be asking better questions about, as you know, these modifications. One of the things I say in the book is, as we modify the planet, we modify ourselves and everything around us. And we need to know what that's going to mean.
We're talking with author Caitlin Shetterly. Her new book is Modified: GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. When we come back, your calls and emails. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Breakwater, curiosity for life, day school and after school enrichment options for toddlers through eighth grade. BreakwaterSchool.org.
Lab-grown diamonds are getting better and bigger. As stones made by science penetrate the jewelry market, will natural gemstones hold their shine?
I think there'll always be a distinction between what came out of the ground, what took millions and millions of years to make, and what was made in the last 72 hours.
I'm Ari Shapiro, redefining the diamond market, later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
And you can join us for All Things Considered this afternoon at 4. Just about everyone is confused at times with all things digital, from your tablet to phone to apps to streaming to on-demand to podcasts or whatever. And when they keep changing, it doesn't make it any easier. Frustrated or worse? Maine Public is sponsoring what we're calling digital boot camps, where you bring whatever it is that needs some figuring out and explaining to one of our offices, and we'll try and help. We'll be in Bangor Monday, December 5th, Lewiston, December 6th, and Portland Wednesday, December 7th. Don't be shy. We can't always figure everything out either. For information, visit mainepublic.org and click on events.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, one journalist's search to understand GMOs. With me in the studio, Caitlin Shetterly. We're discussing her book, Modified: GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We're going to start this section of the show by having Caitlin read to us a little bit from the book. And this is when you meet the farmer named, young farmer named Zach, right?
Yes. So I've just driven across eastern Colorado and into Nebraska. And I have come up to the area where Zach lives, although I've had a pretty hard time finding him in his fields. Zach Honeycutt drove toward me across an endless swath of brown soybeans, turned his huge green John Deere tractor around in a plume of Nebraska dust, and pulled up next to my small rental car, now covered with a thick layer of prairie dirt. He opened his cab door and called out to me, "Come on up," while tipping up his University of Nebraska Lincoln baseball cap with a smooth brown forearm to show me his face. Startlingly handsome, one blue eye and one almond brown, a tuft of short, dark brown hair. Zach's deer was the size of an army tank and built just like one, too. It made my VW look like an actual bug, a small and irritating pest that had appeared in his fields without invitation. But his genuine smile belied the metallic ruthlessness of the machine, so I clambered up its side, got in, and took a look. Here was the face of America's young, industrial-scale farmer growing GMOs for our nation. An apple pie, you-could-be-my-kids-football-coach kind of guy, totally down to earth and familiar, as if you've known him your whole life, but only now finally woke up enough to notice his incredible sparkle. Along with his baseball cap, he wore a zipped-up maroon fleece, even though the temperature outside his acclimatized tractor was in the high 70s, a pair of shorts, and hiking sneakers. Safely secured and sealed in the cab of Zach's tractor, he turned us around, and we took off across his field to catch up with his brother Brandon, driving the combine.
Lovely. Thank you, Caitlin. You know, it's interesting because in the book, right before you meet Zach, you're feeling really vulnerable out in the fields. You're wondering if you're lost.
Yeah.
And throughout the book, it's kind of a theme, a little bit of a fearfulness about reporting on this topic. Tell me why. Why were you feeling a little bit fearful at certain times in this book?
That's a great question. The book, the topic is contentious in itself, and I had been reporting on it little by little for a few years by then. And sometimes I had gotten in big fights with people. I had called them back and they, you know, had sort of that moment where I wasn't sure everything they had told me made sense and they would start yelling at me when I pushed the envelope. And then I published a piece in Elle magazine in the summer of 2013 called The Bad Seed. And it was about GMOs, and it was about my experience with illness and then sort of the tip of the iceberg of starting to research this topic. When the piece came out, I was attacked really hard by Big Ag, and it was sort of a shocking moment. I didn't expect it necessarily to eventuate that way, and they were certainly vituperative in their attacks, the few people who went after me. What was really interesting is that later, and I didn't know this, I don't know what it would have changed necessarily, but I didn't know this when I was doing the reporting for the book. But last winter, when we were doing the legal and fact checking, we found out from a reporter at the New York Times named Eric Lipton, who I think he was on Fresh Air last night. We found out from him that he had been reading the emails that the U.S. Right to Know campaign had gotten from a FOIA, and he had discovered that my name was in them. And he found that a Monsanto exec named Eric Sachs had actually asked the people to attack me who had. He had actually suggested the attacks and suggested how they deal with me, and that they discredit me. What was interesting about that whole experience, however, was that because they attacked me so hard, they actually helped my piece go viral in Elle. And they were sexist in their attacks. Not only did they attack me as a woman and call me ridiculous and things like that, but they also made the fatal flaw of suggesting that Elle magazine perhaps couldn't handle hard journalism like this, which made the editor-in-chief of Elle stand up and defend the piece and defend my reporting, which then made women read the piece, which then helped me sell a book. So that history was behind me as I drove across this country and then went to Europe and went to California. Also, I knew some scientists by then, people I knew I was going to come and interview, who had been attacked by Big Ag and whose careers had been threatened. And at least two of them had been intimidated. One had felt his life was threatened. So I guess I felt, knowing what I know about big tobacco and some of these things, when people stand up to these big corporations, I was tentative at times, for sure. And I felt vulnerable as a woman, I think, too, because I was often the only woman around.
We're going to go to the calls, and we're going to start with Tim, who's calling from Thomaston. Hi, Tim. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling with Caitlin Shetterly.
Hi. Thank you. Thanks for taking my call. This is a really important topic, and I'm glad you're discussing it. What I was going to comment on is that a lot of people don't realize the revolving door policy, so to speak, that exists with companies like Monsanto, as you were talking about, and, you know, high-level executives from Monsanto being appointed to federal oversight committees, such as the FDA and the Department of Agriculture, which is just an incredible conflict of interest that I'm shocked isn't discussed more in the media with some really penetrating journalistic movement. You know, it's really shocking.
Sure, and there's a lot of conflict of interest throughout, isn't there, Caitlin?
Yeah, Tim, I'm so glad you bring that up. I mean, you know, just in sort of recent news, to remind listeners, you know, we've seen the just in the last few months, the Monsanto-Bayer merger, of course, which there's serious conflict of interest there. The, you know, 90% of our seeds are made by the chemical companies, which, of course, make the chemicals for those seeds. And now they're going to join forces with Bayer to make the medicines we may need if we get sick from those seeds and chemicals. And, you know, with Trump now, of course, he's appointing Myron Ebel, who is a climate change denier, since obviously a friend of industry, of logging, fracking, oil, and biotech. And he's going to be the head of the EPA. And it sounds like what his job is going to be is to dismantle it. What's scary about this is the EPA, I found the EPA, the FDA, and the USDA are in many respects pretty toothless. And there's a funny exchange in the book where I interview the head of the USDA about that, and he gets angry at me when I ask him that question, says he doesn't believe it's toothless. But, you know, these appointments that Trump will be making are going to undo so many things. Like, you know, for instance, Obama signed the Chemical Safety for the 21st Century Act this summer, which is going to start to scrutinize some of the chemicals that the EPA has not been able to scrutinize. They've only ever been able to scrutinize 200 chemicals and ban 5, and we currently have 85,000 chemicals circulating in the environment. Close to 800 are released into our air, soil, and water every year. And I have no idea what's going to happen with that act. I'm deeply concerned by the appointment of Myron Ebel, for sure.
Tim, thanks for your call. Moving to Southwest Harbor and Dick. Hi, Dick. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks a lot. I'm just thrilled. I was, in spite of having worked on the GMO issue now for quite a few years, I hadn't heard of Caitlin's book, and I'm just thrilled that something like that's out there. I've just ordered it on Amazon. Look forward to getting it. What I wanted to say, a couple of things. If she's looking for women, Stephanie Seneff from MIT is a wonderful person on the risks of glyphosate in terms of its damage at very low, the lower levels of your metabolism, and how it may be affecting any number of long-term major chronic diseases that we've had ever since GMOs became introduced back in the mid-90s. There was a really good study, which I'm sure is in her book, by a French scientist, Mr. Seralini, which was the only actual good testing of both Roundup and GMOs in terms of their health effects, which turned out very serious problems. And Mr. Seralini was attacked in the same way that Caitlin was. Worldwide, he was assaulted, and his paper was removed for a while because the industry really doesn't want this to get out. But the only other thing is that when she referred to gene guns, the way it works is that they blast this little, what they call a cassette of gene material that does what they want it to do. They just blast it into the DNA, and they have no idea. It's sort of like carpet bombing. They really don't know where it goes, what it's doing, and it was all based on the idea that you've got one gene and it makes one protein, and one gene makes another protein. which was back in the 70s, what they thought. And they've discovered that, in fact, the whole thing is a long integrated whole that regulates all kinds of aspects of how the genes work.
Sure, Dick. I want to get back to something you said about a minute ago, which is about scientists being attacked for the work they're doing. One of the things, Caitlin, that you have almost as a theme in this book is how little research there is and how there's not enough science. And the reason is because scientists don't have the funding to do the work, and some are afraid to do the work, aren't they?
Yeah. Dick, you bring up so many good points. I could probably spend the next 15 minutes talking about everything you just brought up. But absolutely, there's one scientist says to me, look, we're in a research recession. There just isn't the funding out there to answer some of the questions you're asking. And some of the scientists who have been attacked are in my book. In fact, I think there are three or four whose careers were really changed and lives were changed. Tyrone Hayes is at the end of the book, who took on Syngenta and atrazine. Ignacio Chapela, who's a Mexican-born, now lives in America and is a professor at UC Berkeley, who's found that corn was being contaminated in the Oaxacan highlands. So absolutely, there's a real risk to the career if you don't have tenure. And then what I found doing the research was for the book was that a lot of the funding in all these research universities comes from biotech. But, you know, this isn't a new story. Look at this recent story with sugar, right? And these Harvard professors that were, paid off, or however it worked, to suppress the truth about sugar and heart disease, or a similar story that just came up about soda. And the tobacco industry, this keeps happening. We shouldn't be surprised by this happening and by the incredible power, lobbying power, that these corporations have, and the fact that they are co-opting and capturing not only our regulatory agencies, but also our universities. So when a scientist who is truly independent wants to take on this issue, as I have a couple in the book and I delineate what happened to them, they are risking certainly their careers, and some of them felt maybe their families or their lives.
Thanks for your call, Dick. We're going to go to Rockland and Muriel. Hi, Muriel. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I wanted to ask Caitlin only one thing. What can we do, Joe Average, us mice driving down the street? Clearly voting didn't seem to help us much. What can we do?
That's a great question. The most important thing we can do is to, I would say, eat organic. Okay. Easier said than done. It's, unfortunately, organic has this kind of Eileen Fisher wearing Volvo driving image. But I think if we buy from our local farmers and we look them in the eye and ask them what they're using on their crops, and we ask for cleaner food, and we ask to support organics, I think that we can make a difference that way. I also think that we can stop using pesticides. Pesticides are for me, the revelation of this book was that the GMO was one thing, but the pesticides were a really, really serious issue. And there are some groups in Maine that are working very hard to ban pesticides. There's a group right here in Portland. South Portland has banned pesticides, and we need to be doing that. Don't use any pesticides in your home or on your lawn, around your home. You, not only are you affecting yourself, but you're affecting birds and fish and frogs and bees. So we need to make some hard but ultimately I think fruitful choices about the products we're using and the food we eat.
Muriel, thanks so much for your call. Before we go to another break, Caitlin, I want to ask you, though, you don't necessarily believe that all GMOs are bad.
I don't know. I mean, the jury is still out on that. I guess that's how I would say. I think that the vast majority of the GMOs I'm talking about in the book are corn, soy, cotton, sugar beets. We are blanketing the planet with those. And I'm not even talking about GMO trees, which we're raising these jungles in South America. And we're starting to do, I guess, in the south of this country to grow GMO eucalyptus trees. These are, Jonathan Franzen in The New Yorker called these sterile unforests. These are forests have been teeming with life, and now they're these plantations. I'm really concerned about what we're doing to the planet, not only growing these crops, planting them, spraying with them with pesticides, but how they might modify the environment. There may be a good GMO. There's a wheat that's being developed in China to withstand fungus, which will require less fungicides, supposedly. Does that mean that pesticides aren't being used to grow this wheat? I don't know the answer to that question. You know, the virus-resistant papaya, is the GMO part of it actually the problem, or is some of the other chemicals that get sprayed on those papayas? You know, we need to start asking these questions. And I think the Zika situation presents a perfect opportunity to really figure out what we believe. Are we going to spray the entire planet, or might we choose one of these other two options? There are two GMO mosquitoes, one which is being bred to disarm the virus, and the other one which is being bred to be the mosquito that ends all mosquitoes. I actually am cautiously in favor of the middle option, the one that would disarm the virus. I think it's much more dangerous, perhaps, to babies in utero to have the whole planet sprayed for mosquitoes. And I don't think we should end all mosquitoes, because that's going to affect everything in the ecosystem. So we have some tough choices on this planet to make, and we have to understand when we make them, you know, once you let the genie out of the bottle, it's out. But what are those choices going to be going forward? And how can we protect not only ourselves, but also the other plants and fauna that we share the planet with?
We do have to take another short break. When we return, more of your comments and questions. Please stay with us.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Dixfield Foam Insulation, committed to conserving energy in new and existing buildings through spray insulation. DixfieldFoamInsulation.com. Good Shepherd Food Bank, partnering to end hunger in Maine, harvesting hope for families in need this holiday season. Learn how you can help at feedingmaine.org. And Condo Furniture by Endicott Home, offering non-toxic solutions for downsizing and living well in smaller spaces. CondoFurniture.com.
President-elect Trump has tweeted that he will be taking himself out of his business operation. But is that enough to address potential conflicts of interest? On the next Fresh Air, we discuss Trump's domestic and international business holdings, the potential conflicts, and the law and ethics surrounding conflicts with Eric Lipton, an investigative reporter for The New York Times. Join us.
And join us for Fresh Air this evening at 7 o'clock. Many of your favorite Maine Public Television and PBS programs are now available to everyone online through our Video On Demand tool at mainepublic.org. And now, qualified supporters also have access to Passport, which allows extended access to many of the program archives, such as the ability to watch entire series or access past programs that previously may not have been available. Passport is already available to supporters of both Maine Public Television and Radio at the $60 a year or $5 a month level. If you're interested in learning more or gaining access to Passport for yourself, please visit mainepublic.org. Thanks.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Caitlin Shetterly is with me. She is the author of the new book, Modified. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. I have an email from Don on Facebook, Facebook post from Don on Facebook. Not all GMO proponents are big ag. Where's the proof? Hard data linking GMOs and disease? How does Caitlin know that her disease was due to GMO and not just to... I can't read the rest of it. It was due to GMO. It seems as though GMO folks are jumping to the conclusion that it's bad without proof, like anti-vaxxers and autism.
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, throughout the book, as you know, Jennifer, I ask this question of myself. I'm really hard on myself in that I'm willing to be disproven. And, you know, I don't know, when we changed our diet in favor of all organic and local and everything homemade, there's no way for me to prove on myself, being my own mouse, that it was the GMO necessarily. I do know I got better. And so I asked this question throughout the book. And, you know, he's exactly right. How do we know? Where is our sort of verifiable proof? We don't necessarily have that. All I can submit are the studies that I did read, the scientists I spoke to, and, you know, my continued concern about pesticides. And it's possible that when I took the GMO out, I took out some pesticide that was disrupting my body in some way. I just don't know. And I think that's a really great question. I think connecting people who are anti-GMO to anti-vax or, you know, people who are against vaccines or and think that there's a link to autism or people who drink raw milk or whatever, I think that's a little too easy. And I think there are lots of extremely well-educated people who think vaccines are just fine who have trouble with the idea of GMOs.
We're going to go to Franca, who's calling from South Paris. Hi, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I'm calling because years ago, I'd say it was like the end of the 70s, all of a sudden, a lot of the third world countries, which were surviving in their own seeds, their own style of living, all of a sudden they had a famine. They didn't have enough crops. And Monsanto came in offering all these seeds, supposedly miracle seeds. Well, these poor people bought into it. Not just one country, many of the third world. And they didn't know that these would not germinate automatically like the native plants. So they had to go out and buy more seeds every year. And eventually, the thing just conked out. People didn't have the money, and they found themselves trying to get their seeds back, and they didn't have them. And I think that was the beginning, the turning point of third world countries having the famine that they're having now. And they've had for the past 20 years.
Sure, Franca. I understand linking the big ag seeds to the famines in many parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really great question. I mean, you know, when you think about it, the way she's describing it, you might wonder if some of these companies shouldn't be sort of tried for crimes against humanity, because I do discuss sort of India in the book and how, you know, farmers who have gotten into this situation of buying the seeds and they have to buy the pesticides that go with them. And then if there's a drought or incredible flooding, they lose everything and then they have to borrow against next year's harvest. And there's been this huge suicide rate in India. And the question is it tied to, you know, the GMO? And some people like Vandana Shiva believe it is. But, you know, as far as hunger goes, you know, that's the thing that's been proven now is that the GMO seed has not ended or even staved off worldwide hunger. In fact, we currently have, and this is a conservative estimate, I guess, over 1 billion undernourished people. And that doesn't include, I heard George Mitchell on MPBN recently talking about kids in Waterville who are hungry and spend the whole weekend not getting enough food and then come in for the breakfast and lunch program. You know, we have those are the chronically hungry, which don't even necessarily fit into that number. We have a serious situation, and these seeds have done nothing to alleviate worldwide hunger. In fact, it has increased steadily since the advent of the GMO.
Franca, thanks so much for your call. Sarah on Facebook writes, I had a similar experience to Caitlin's with intestinal inflammation. I figured out it appears to be glyphosate, am I pronouncing that right, mm-hmm. Residue in my food. Companies rushed this technology to market without thoroughly testing it. We are the test.
It's interesting she says that. One of the scientists in my book, a very well-regarded on both sides of the aisle scientists, he said to me, we are the ultimate animal study. And those words really resonated with me. And I would take those a step further and say, well, actually, our children are the ultimate animal study. Our children now are going to be exposed to more chemicals than any human beings ever have been. And I have two little small children, and these are chemicals that are outside the limit of biologic experience, as Rachel Carson says. And in fact, bringing it to Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring, she was a terrific influence of mine. And she says something I think is so important. She said, man's war against nature is inevitably a war against himself. And I took those words really to heart. I also wondered the whole time I was writing my book, how did she write Silent Spring and bring our attention to these dangerous chemicals, one of which has ever been banned, DDT, and we are still using them. And in fact, we've actually increased our use of toxic chemicals. How did this happen?
We'll go to Richard, who's calling from Standish. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. Caitlin, thanks for your book. It sounds great. I'm looking forward to reading it. I was wondering if you're familiar with a gentleman named C.R. Lawn?
No.
He writes a paper every year for Fedco Seeds Catalog. And he's been diatribing against Monsanto and agribusiness for a good 15 years now. He writes very passionately and very intelligently, and I'd recommend his reading to anybody. And Fedco Seeds themselves refuse to carry any GMO seeds. Most of their seeds are organic. They're right here in Maine, and a great resource for anyone.
Thanks, Richard. We have Fedco and Johnny's right here in Maine.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And in fact, I buy all my seeds from Fedco as well. And John Bunker, who is involved with Fedco, he actually ends my book. And so, looking to Fedco for ideas and solutions is something everyone here in Maine can and should do.
Richard, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Fairfield and Marilyn. Hi, Marilyn. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm a farmer. In central Maine, I grow 100 acres of apples. I have 12 acres of certified organic orchard, and I'd like to comment about your saying eat organic as being pesticide-free. That just isn't a true statement. You will not get a perfect or even sometimes a crop if you don't do something. And there are certified organic materials. We started off 42 years ago thinking that everything could be done organically. All you had to do was do it. Well, that just isn't the case. We've been spending a lifetime now doing this, and I just want you to know, organic is not necessarily pesticide-free.
Thanks, Marilyn. And you're nodding, Caitlin. That's true. The caller before asked what a first step could be, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are, you know, certainly some pesticides. I think with apples, some people spray actually a clay material on the outside of the apple. There are some things that are just considered safer and are certified, under the organic label and are less dangerous. I mean, I think that, you know, one of the scientists in my book says, you know, if it's designed to kill something, of course, it's not safe. So, of course, mitigating the risk and looking at is clay going to be safer than some other sort of neonicotinoid? Probably,
Marilyn, thanks so much for your call. You know, we have just about a minute left, Caitlin, so I want to ask you, I know that you mentioned earlier in the program and say in the book how you really make all your food from scratch at home. You grow a lot of it. You shop at farmers markets. What are you going to do for the holidays?
I love this question. That's great. Well, the holidays have become, with two little children, all about making it easy. We will certainly be making our gingerbread cookies and things like that. But last year, I made quiches I made homemade quiches, and I froze them and brought them out Christmas morning and was able to thaw those for breakfast with some fruit. And usually we make a roast every year, and we get our grass-fed beef from a place called Sebago Lake Ranch in Gorham. And I think we'll probably make a roast, and I usually deglaze it with a little Concord grape jelly and red wine, and then probably some potatoes, au gratin, and salad. This year, we're pretty excited that we're going to make a raspberry pie from our own raspberries. And, I just look forward to having an easy time with lots of homemade cooking and little nibbles around. Christmas Eve, I usually make a fish stew. A whole bunch of different kinds of fish and in a sort of a bouillabaisse tomato broth. And
you feel good eating
all
this.
I feel good eating all that and feeding it to my children. I definitely do.
Well, thank you so much. Caitlin Shetterly is the author of the many books, the memoir Made for You and Me, Going West, Going Broke, and Finding Home. She edited the bestseller Fault Lines, Stories of Divorce, and her new book that she talked about here today, Modified, GMOs and the Threat to Our Food, Our Land, Our Future. On December 16th, Bessie's Farm Goods in Freeport is hosting Caitlin for a signing and meet and greet from 5 to 7. On December 20th, Caitlin is doing a signing with Sherman's Books at the Portland Co-op. John Keimel ran the board today. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 7. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.